Venu of bamboo. Sankarshajaha, generated by the friction. Vanehi, fire. Dabha, having burned. Shamyati,
is pacified.
Tat, of bamboo. Vanam, the forest. Evam, thus. Guna,
of the modes of nature.
Avyatya jaha, generated by interaction. Deyaha,
the material body.
Shamyati, is pacified. Tat, as the fire. Kriyaha,
performing the same action.
So translation. In a bamboo forest, the wind sometimes rubs the bamboo stalks together, and such friction generates a blazing fire that consumes the very source of its birth, the bamboo forest. Thus the fire is automatically calmed by its own action. Similarly, by the competition and interaction of the material modes of nature, the subtle and gross material bodies are generated. If one uses his mind and body to cultivate knowledge, then such enlightenment destroys the influence of the modes of nature that generated one's body. Thus, like the fire, the body and mind are pacified by their own actions in destroying the source of their birth. So you can repeat. In a bamboo forest, the wind sometimes rubs
the
bamboo stalks together,
and such friction generates
a blazing fire that consumes
the very source of its birth,
the bamboo forest.
Thus the fire is automatically calmed
by its own action.
Similarly, by the competition and interaction
of the material modes of nature,
the subtle and gross material bodies
are generated.
If one uses his mind and body
to cultivate knowledge,
then such enlightenment
destroys the influence
of the modes of nature
that generated one's body.
Thus, like the fire,
the body and mind are pacified
by their own actions
in destroying the source of their birth.
So purport by the servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
The Prabhupada Jai. The word aguna vyatyaja jaha is significant in this verse.
Vyatyaya indicates change or inversion in the normal order of things.
Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur has described the concept of vyatyaya by giving the Sanskrit synonym avaishamya, which indicates inequality or disproportionate diversity.
So, do I need to explain that?
Yeah. Diversity means, you know, things are different. Disproportionate means that things are not in proportion to each other. In other words, one thing is much bigger than the other thing or in competition with another thing.
Thus, it is understood by the word term, guna vyatya jaha, that the body is generated by the unstable relationships of the three modes of material nature, which exist everywhere in constantly changing proportions. There is constant strife among the modes of nature. A good person is sometimes torn by passion, and a passionate person sometimes wants to give up everything and rest. An ignorant person may sometimes become disgusted with his depraved life, and a passionate person may sometimes indulge in bad habits in the mode of ignorance. Due to the interactive conflict of the modes of nature, One wanders throughout material nature, creating one body after another by one's own work or karma. As it is said, variety is the mother of enjoyment, and the variety of material modes gives hope to the conditioned souls that by changing their material situation, their unhappiness and frustration can be turned into happiness and satisfaction. But even if one acquires relative material happiness, that will soon be disturbed by the inevitable flux of the material modes.
Venu sankharsha jovanir dhugva shamyati tatvanam evam guna vyatyaya jo deha shamyati tatkriyaha.
So omagana timirandasha granjana shalakaya chakshur unmilitam yena tasmai shigurave namaha.
So it is stated that the material energy is endlessly mutable. That means it's always changing. And even the Greek philosophers understood this, and I forget the name of the pre-Socratic philosopher who stated, you cannot step into the same river twice. The reason you can't step into the same river twice is that the river is always flowing. And of course, the flow in this material world is due to the action of the time factor. You know, without the time factor, everything would be very static. But because of the interaction of the modes and the time factor, you have everything changing all the time. I mean, obviously, we understand the time factor, especially as you get older, you do understand the time factor more and more. I mean, all you have to do is look in the mirror. You know, mirror, mirror on the wall. What happened to that brahmachari or lady or sannyasi of 20 years ago? And you'll see that so many things occur due to the time factor. You know, wrinkles, as I sometimes give the funny example. Actually, many times I give different examples to people. I said, look, when you're young, you're like a plum, and when you get older, you're like a prune. You understand? Plum. A prune is like a wrinkled plum. Or another funny example I give. Sometimes I'm advising people in their marriages. You know, somehow the sannyasis get caught up in these things. And I say to someone, if you want to understand how your wife is going to look in 20 or 25 years from now, go meet her mother. And that's who you're going to be married to in 20 years from now. And many times people decide not to get married after. Not really, it doesn't work like that. Because illusion is very strong. But anyway, so because the time factor is like that, it's changing everything continually. And it's immutable and incontrovertible. You can't stop it. You just can't stop it. It's like trying to stop the Ganges River. You just can't stop it. Or it's just stopping a tsunami. That's a better example. You know, obviously you just can't stop it, so you just have to go, as they say, go with the flow. So this time factor agitates the three modes of material nature, and as described here, those three modes, they actually interact with each other, and sometimes in a non-proportionate way. In other words, one mode is stronger than the other mode, and it creates your body. So that's all your body is. It's the interaction of the modes of nature instilled or by the time factor. They're just interacting in a certain way, and everybody's body can be understood as a combination of the three modes of nature. In other words, just like you have three different colors, that all colors can be understood as a combination of those three primary colors, right? They're like if you have a television. Of course, nowadays all the devotees have televisions. And satellite televisions too. But if you have a television, it's just basically three different colors. If you look very, very closely, you take a microscope or, you know, just even a magnifying glass, look very closely at the screen, you'll see actually three different, what's called pixels. And these pixels are red, blue, and green. And these pixels are interacting in such a way to give you the whole spectrum of colors. It's spectrum means like every color imaginable. You know, yellow, purple, chartreuse, polka dots, or whatever color you may happen to be looking at. So in the same way, the three modes of nature are like that. And so you can look at someone's body. I mean, like the Ayurveda is expert in that. An Ayurvedic physician would be expert in that, be able to analyze your body. Like if you have this vata, pitta, kapha. You understand? You have these three different things. Vata, of course, means the air constitution. And pitta means the fire constitution. And kapha is like the mucus constitution. So some people have bodies that are very kapha, which means, you know, they're very, let's say they're challenged in the weight department.
Strong bones.
Yeah, they're strong in bones and they're challenged in the weight department. I mean, we use that word challenged right now instead of overweight. Yeah, that's a politically correct term. Instead of saying someone's overweight, you say they're challenged. They're, what do they say? Horizontally challenged. And if someone is short, like I have one short disciple, very short, Gopal, and I say he's vertically challenged. Or if someone is not so intelligent, they're psychologically or intellectually challenged. You don't say someone's crazy anymore. You just say they're psychologically challenged. Anyway, politically correct language. So that the kapha, and then pitta is, you know, someone who's very fiery. They can digest anything, even eat nails. And then vata. You know, they're very airy, you know, they're spaced out, so to speak. And the Ayurvedic physician can actually touch your veins and arteries, take your pulse, and understand which constitution you are. I mean, so these are the three modes of nature again. And as we were mentioning yesterday, that everything in this world is composed, you can analyze in terms of the modes of nature. Whether it's food, whether it's the time of the day, whether it's determination, this is Bhagavad Gita, basic Bhagavad Gita philosophy, whether it's understandings in the mode of passion, ignorance, or goodness, whether it's work, whether it's workers, it's all the three modes of nature. I mean, it's really an easy way to understand this material world. So, as we mentioned in the beginning of the class, the three modes are not stable because of the time factor. And so one situation, of course, you're not changing your body so quickly, but at least your psychology, mentality changes from moment to moment. I mean, perhaps a few hours ago we were sleeping, we were in the mode of ignorance. And now we're also sleeping in Bhagavatam class. So that's in the mode, I don't know what mode that is, but anyway, it's like mixed mode of goodness. It's good ignorance, yeah. Like one devotee very jokingly said that if you're having trouble, you go to having trouble sleeping at night, instead of taking a sleeping pill, you go to Bhagavatam class, because the injunction is Nashta Prayeshu Avadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. That if one hears Bhagavatam, all the inauspicious things in the heart are destroyed, so the inauspicious things are what's keeping you from sleeping soundly at night. Anyway, it was a joke. So So it changes, and then the times of the day. Right now we're in the time of the day that's a goodness. And in a few minutes, it'll change to passion. And that is described in the purport last night, yesterday morning, of course. Then in the evening it's ignorance. So everything is in constant flux like that, and we have to be conscious of the flux that's occurring in our consciousness in order to remain stable in Krishna consciousness. Now, as far as being devotees, I mean, that's another point that's very important to make, that we think we're devotees and therefore we're transcendental to the three modes of material nature. Well, I got news for you. First of all, we're not devotees. That's the first point. Devotee wrote Prabhupada a letter, and in that letter he called himself a devotee, and Prabhupada said a devotee never calls himself a devotee. Because an actual devotee is one who is devoted. I mean, anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karana anavratam. As Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu stated, He said, I have no love for Krishna. Because if I had love for Krishna, how could I live in this world? So basically, we shouldn't think of ourselves as devotees. Of course, if someone asks us on Sankirtan or we're out in the public, are you a devotee? We say we're a devotee. I mean, we don't say to some non-devotee or somebody who we meet in the street, no, I'm not a devotee, I'm just a demon. Although we may be thinking that internally, it won't come out very well if we're preaching Krishna consciousness. So in that case, we identify ourselves as a devotee. But internally, we should think, no, I'm aspiring to be a servant of a servant of a servant of a servant of a devotee. I'm aspiring for that. And sometimes I'm not even aspiring for that. Sometimes I'm aspiring to please my senses. And sometimes I'm aspiring to kill people. It's like I was with a devotee one time. No one here, of course. And we were driving, he was driving a car, and someone cut him off, and he said, Maharaj, give me permission to go out and beat this guy up. Rage. And, you know, because we're so proud, we think these are all part, these emotions are part and parcel of devotional service, but they're not. You know, we are influenced by the modes of nature. Therefore, you find in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Kapila Dev very elaborately describes different types of devotional service in the different modes of nature. I believe it's the ninth chapter in the third canto. And different devotees in different modes of nature. Which is interesting. You know, devotional service in the mode of ignorance, devotional service in the mode of passion, devotional service in the mode of goodness. And devotees in the mode of those three different modes. I mean, for example, devotional service in the mode of ignorance is just like, basically, one is just angry, envious, separatist. The word separatist is also used in the Bhagavatam. Separatist basically means that one has a separate interest other than the interest of the Lord. So we can see sometimes, of course we shouldn't go around finding fault in devotees and say, hey, you're a devotee in the mode of ignorance. But we can see when we're influenced by that, we're envious of someone. Let's say someone is doing something nicely, someone dresses the duties nicely, and we feel this burning sensation in our hearts. Anyone's ever felt that burning sensation in your heart? When someone else does something nicely, chants better than you, or dresses the deities better than you, or cooks better than you, or preaches better than you, or any of these things. Or makes more money than you, you know, has a bigger house than you have. You just feel this, your mouth scrunches up, and you just, I mean, even you can see it. There's physical sense, physical manifestations of it. You actually get claws. It's like our friend Supanaka. You know Supanaka?
Oh yeah,
Supanaka. Supanaka means the one with the long nails. That's actually what the name means in Sanskrit. Supanaka, long, like curved nails. So just like when you get envious, actually you're, isn't it? Think about it for a second. Your hands start to scrunch up like that. Doesn't it? And your teeth are clenched. So there's actually physical manifestations of envy. So we do experience this envy. And that's ignorance. That's ignorance. That's devotional service in ignorance. Anger, envy, separatism, things like that. And then in passion, how can we identify passion? We want to be appreciated for our service. Appreciated or praised. Like after we dress the deities, we go to someone else and we say, oh, how do you think the deities look today? Actually, we're not interested in praising the deities, we're interested in praising ourselves. Right? Anyone ever do that? How do you think the deities look? Someone will say, they look really good. And you think, oh, I'm really good. Even though they're praising the deities, you're taking it as praise of yourself. So that's someone who's interested, and also fruitive gain as devotional service in the mode of passion. We see a lot of this in the Indian culture with the Satyanarayan Katha. Anyone heard of Satyanarayan Katha before? That means where people go And they talk about these different stories from the Vedic literatures, how someone worshipped Narayan, and they got this. For example, even if someone just concentrates on that story of Sudama Brahman, and that enlivens them so much because they think they can become like Sudama Brahman.
Get
the big castle with a swimming pool and servants for your wife and everything like that. I mean, I know in some of our temples we specifically put a picture of the pastime of Sudama Brahman so people will be encouraged to give donations to the deities. Hmm. And then in India, people come and make deals with the deities. They do business. They go to Balaji, for example. And they say, "My dear Balaji, if this business deal is successful, I will give you 50%. And they do. So they're doing business. As I said, Baniya. They're Paka Baniya, which means they're a good businessman. So one time, there's an interesting story in Tirupati, Tirumala one time. Someone came to do a business deal with the deities, and they also wanted their son blessed. So they had their son, they held their son over the hundi. Everybody knows what a hundi is? Hundi is a donation box. Just like you have a hundi here. In Tirupati or Tirumala, the donation box is, how do I describe it? It's as big as the altar, basically, one of the altars here. I mean, really big. There's people who drop in gold bars and everything in it. So one man, he wanted to bless his son. So he had his son drop some donation in the deity box. But by accident, his hand slipped, and his son fell into the donation box. And so he said to the pujaris, "Give me back my son." They said, "No, you've given your son to Balaji." They wouldn't give him back. You know the story. They wouldn't give his son back. And his son became a pujari anyway. So a happy ending. But sometimes you want to do a business deal with Krishna, and of course Krishna does take away things, like Krishna says in the Bhagavatam. Yashaham anagrinamayi harishye tad dhanam shanahai. That for those who I especially favor, I take away everything. Prabhupada was very fond of quoting that verse, especially in this one poem that Srila Prabhupada wrote, which I mentioned before, Vrindavan Bhajan, which Prabhupada is lamenting. He said, you know, "I have my wife, my family and everything, but they're all fruitless now because I have no money. They're not interested in me anymore." Prabhupada said, Krishna is showing him the naked face of reality. And then Prabhupada said, I laugh when I see this. You should read this poem. It's a very interesting poem. So sometimes people approach Krishna for some ulterior purpose, but then Krishna takes away everything. So therefore it's a little dangerous to approach Krishna. So anyway, so that's devotional service in the mode of passion, and devotional service in the mode of goodness. One is doing devotional service basically for liberation. As Prabhupada said, we should want to go back to Godhead. So that Prabhupada was actually encouraging that. Why? Because people approach Krishna for ulterior motives. Krishna himself says that in the Gita. What does he say? Chatur vidha bhajanti mam. People approach me because they're in distress, they want money, they're inquisitive, or they want knowledge. So Krishna is aware of that. So Prabhupada encouraged us. Yes, you should, like a devotee said to Prabhupada one time, "I just want to stay in the material world and serve." And Prabhupada said, "No, you should want to go back to Godhead." Because Prabhupada understood that particular person's psychology. He wasn't speaking honestly. I mean, many times we speak dishonestly. "Oh, I just want to serve you, Krishna. That's all I want." But actually, in our hearts, we're thinking, "I don't want that." So there's a disconnect between what we're saying, or even what we're thinking consciously, and who we are, which is really important. Therefore, I tell the devotees, if you want to chant the Hare Krishna mantra properly, you have to really know who you are. You have to know what stage you're at rather than trying to imitate a higher stage in devotional service. I mean, if you say to Krishna, Sri Shiva Pada Panashtumama Darshanamamato Kurotuva Yata Tata Bhavatada Tumam Lampato Pananatas to Seva Naparaha, that Krishna, you can do anything to me, you're being really dishonest with yourself and with others. Because you don't really feel like that. I mean, does anyone here feel like that? Krishna, you can do anything. You can smash me. You can leave me brokenhearted. You can be a debauchee. But I'll continue to worship you. No, we're thinking in our hearts, Krishna, you better do this, you better do that, or else I'm not going to worship you. So we have to be really honest. That's why Lord Chaitanya Shikshastika is actually a hierarchy of steps in devotional service. If you read it like that, it's really interesting. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, of course, has analyzed it like that as a hierarchy in terms of the different levels of progress in devotional service. So we can always find one verse in the Shikshastika that resonates with us. Like, especially the one Prabhupada emphasized was Ainanda Tanuja Kinkaram Patitam Mam Bishame Bhavambudo Kripaya Tava Pada Pankaja Sita Duli Sadrasam Pachintya. Oh, son of Nanda Maharaj, I'm your eternal servant, but somehow or other I've fallen into this horrible ocean of birth and death. Please fix me up and save me. In other words, we can realize the material world is suffering, is miserable, so we can pray at least in that way. Of course, Dhruva Maharaj, he was praying for some material things, but we should at least pray to go back to Godhead. That's honest. So that's devotional service in the mode of goodness. Whereas in the mode, or transcendental mode of goodness, the Shuddha Shatva, it's described that one's devotional service is just spontaneous. It's like the description given by Lord Kapiladeva, it's like the Ganges water or the water of a river that just rushes spontaneously to the ocean. It just rushes there. I mean, you don't have to make an arrangement for it or anything like that. So that's actually transcendental devotional service, where spontaneously you're serving Krishna. So we can see how these modes are affecting us, you know, what mode we're performing devotional service in at a particular time, and analyze this and be honest with ourselves. The devotee should be honest, not dishonest. I find a lot of, like, dishonesty, not in terms of stealing or cheating or anything like that. I find a lot of dishonesty with devotees, because we think we're better than we actually are. So we are affected by the modes of nature. Of course, I don't want to offend any of you that are transcendental sitting here. But in general, most of us are affected by the modes of nature. And just know that's the modes. Otherwise, you'll think it's transcendental. You'll think your envy is transcendental, and then you'll make a web page criticizing Vaishnavas. You know, Sampradaya's son. I mean, I hate to mention it, isn't it? They think it's my service to Prabhupada to criticize Vaishnavas. Isn't it? I mean, it means there's a disconnect. The person who is running that site must have a disconnect between his who he is and who he thinks he is. Because he's thinking it's service. I mean, he's honestly thinking it's service. I know, I've talked to him already about it. He thinks he's serving Prabhupada. He doesn't think I'm criticizing Vaishnavas. So you actually begin to think that your devotional service in the mode of ignorance is pure devotional service. Or, you know, what to speak of sahajas who are projecting their own lust upon the transcendental plane, and they think that that's transcendental. But it's just like, it's lust. That's all it is. It's just lust. Like Prabhupada said, if one tries to understand or reads these elevated literatures, instead of becoming purified, he becomes putrefied. The same, Prabhupada described like medicine. Medicine has to be prescribed by an expert physician or pharmacologist or pharmacist. Otherwise, one medicine that may be good for one person may be deadly for another person. So really we need some honesty. You know, internal, introspective type of honesty. You know, who I am, you know, and what platform I'm at and what modes of nature are affecting me right now. Otherwise, you're going to be prey for Maya. You'd be performing devotional service in the modes, obviously. Okay, so that's one point here. So the next point made in the purport, I mean the translation, is that you can use this body and the mind, which have come from the interaction of the modes of nature, instigated by the time factor, you can use it to become Krishna conscious, which is really interesting. And the example given in the Vedic literature is it takes a thorn to extract a thorn. I don't know if any of you ever walked in Vrindavan, there's these big thorns about this big. And even if you're wearing a shoe, they go through them. Anyone experience that? It's super thorns. And they don't need to make fences with barbed wire there. They just take the bushes. You ever see that in Vrindavan?
No, I haven't seen it.
They take the bushes and then put them around the property. And that's barbed wire, barbed thorn fences. So you get these big thorns in you sometimes when you're going around Govardhan. And if you don't have a knife or something like that, you use another thorn to pull it out, to take it out. So this, the same thing, or another example Prabhupada gives, is the example of if one becomes sick from milk products. Does everybody know this example? Then another milk product like yogurt will be the cure for that sickness. So you find the same thing that causes the sickness in a modified form becomes the cause of the health or the cure of that sickness. In the same way, the same thing that is the cause of our entanglement, guna sangasha, karnam guna sangasha, sarasad jamajanishu, the body coming from the guna sangha, the modes of nature, can be the cause of our enlightenment when it's utilized in Krishna. Of course, that's known as yukta vairagya, or the renunciation of using everything in Krishna's service. And so that's our process of Krishna consciousness. Whatever mode or whatever nature your body has, it should be used properly in Krishna consciousness, and that's the duty of the spiritual master to ascertain the psychophysical nature of the disciple and engage them accordingly. Does everybody understand that? Psychophysical, that means mental, psychological, and physical nature. And everybody has different talents. Arjuna's talent was he was a kshatriya, means management, fighting. And someone else's talent may be Brahmin, deity worship. Someone else's talent may be Vaishya. Let him do business for Krishna. And I give the results to Krishna. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a Vaishya's duty. That's why we have Varnashram. I mean, devotees, you cannot avoid this Varnashram concept. Because everybody has bodies of different modes of nature. You know, it's not that everybody, we tried in the beginning of our movement to make everybody a Brahmin. Prabhupada tried. And then Prabhupada understood. He said, you know, it's not working. It's not working long term. Of course, if you keep chanting, you have good sadhana, you can stay on the Brahminical platform no matter who you are. However, people just don't continue with their sadhana like that. And then you have this Punarmushika Bhava principle. That you become what you were before. In other words, whatever modes of nature you were born with, if you're not really good in sadhana, they come out. So then you just use them in Krishna's service. And that's what happened in our movement. You know, people, the previous modes of nature came out. Like one of Prabhupada's servants, Shyamasundara, he decided he wanted to open up a diamond mine or a gold mine somewhere. Because that was his nature. Of course, Prabhupada allowed that, encouraged it. So that's the point. The spiritual master says, sees the disciple and says, this is your nature. Like Krishna said to Arjuna, this is your nature. If you don't fight for me, you're going to be forced to fight by your nature. So therefore, fight for me. That's yukta vairagya. Anasha tasha vishyan yathara mubhiyunjada. Nirbanda Krishna sambandhe yukta vairagyam uchite. That's the renunciation that we have in our Krishna consciousness movement. Whatever your nature, you use it for Krishna. And we need to institute Varnashram in order to formalize this particular procedure. Otherwise, we're going to have people thinking they're Brahmins when they're not actually Brahmins, and it creates havoc in the minds of the public, and it creates havoc
within our institution itself. So this is the second point here. So any questions or comments about these points? Yeah, Kavinder.
So sometimes there's a lot of stress, specifically for forms, and I understand that, that you can't have one ashram without having an agrarian society.
Yeah, that's part of it, yeah.
That's part of it. But the other part of it is that it's a person's psychophysical makeup. And so,
yes,
therefore, you are going to have businessmen and attorneys and this type,
yeah,
and that type, and they have to go work in the type of world that's out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you need Varnashram. I mean, there's one person who's preaching Varnashram in ISKCON, and he says it's only farms. But that's just like part of Varnashram. Mm-hmm. You got to have farms, but you also have to have people who are accustomed or psychophysically, by their nature, they would be happy working on a farm. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you take a businessman, I mean, but that's a different type of Vaishya. But if you take someone who's really inclined to business and you put him on a farm, I mean, he's just going to go crazy. Or he's going to just steal all the vegetables. Yeah, he's going to commercialize it all and just steal the vegetables and sell it, and you won't have any left for the deities. Or something like that. I mean, but that's also Shudra. But, you know, you have to engage people according to their nature. It just doesn't work long term. I mean, short term, yes. Anybody can do anything. Short term. But long term for Krishna, because we're conditioned, we have to work according to our nature. Otherwise, we're not going to be happy. I mean, sometimes we do have to sacrifice. I mean, I've seen, like, I have to sit in GBC meetings, and it's really not my nature to manage or to sit in meetings. I mean, I'd much rather be reading Shastra. Just like we were talking yesterday about going to different concerts, which we have to go to sometimes. And I would say to Yogindra, I mean, how can I sit through this concert? And I was thinking, well, maybe I'll just bring my Kindle with me so I can read Prabhupada's books or something like that during the concert. So, you know, we actually can get really bored doing something that's not our nature. It's really boring. But how do you know what your nature is? It's something you can do for 8 hours a day and not get bored with. That's really easy. I mean, you can do a lot of things, but you can't do a lot of things for 8 hours a day. Do you understand the difference? I mean, just like myself, I know how to fix a car, I know how to fix computers, I know some mathematics, I mean, a lot of different things. I know management too. But if you ask me to fix cars for 8 hours a day, I mean, I'll lose my mind. I mean, I just won't be able to do it. I'll just like, you know, I don't know what I'll do because it's not my nature. But I still know how to do it. Like a Brahmin can know how to do a lot of things, but it's not that he wants to do them all day long.
But he can teach them.
He can teach, yeah. As a Brahmin can teach. But a Brahmin, he can teach even fighting. He can teach car mechanics. He can teach farming. But it's not that he wants to do them all day long. He likes to teach. That's the difference.
Maharaj, what about the ashram aspect of it? Mm. The person's getting older, and how do they retire, although they have a mode that want to keep them working?
Well, you heard of euthanasia? I'm just teasing. I'm just teasing. That's just a joke, you know. I think you keep someone work. Actually, it's only the higher classes that actually retire. I mean, you can't force someone into a retirement mode. First of all, if you force someone into retirement mode, they get depressed.
Don't you say hi?
It's actually shown that even in the material world, when people retire and they still have the energy, they die very quickly after that because they're not interested in life anymore. I mean, how interesting or exciting is it to play golf for the rest of your life? I mean, what do you have to look forward to? If you're a Vaishya, you know, you say, well, today we're going to the golf course. You know, so what? You just want to engage in business. So, I do not find that people change their natures so quickly at 50 or even at 65. So it's primarily Brahmins and even sannyas. is not really recommended in Kali Yuga. So my feeling is that one should keep going, doing what interests him in Krishna's service as long as he can keep going. I mean, it's how else are you going to keep the mind engaged? Sivai manat Krishna putara vindiyo. You have to engage your mind in Krishna's service. And so if you prematurely, before you're actually in the mode of goodness, to say your business is just hearing and chanting, I mean, first of all, you're going to probably look for another family at 60 years old. I've seen that happen.
Or look at a lot of television.
Or television, or movies, or whatever, or the news. It's just not natural. Yeah.
Sorry, but isn't it that in Varnashram only Brahmins are supposed to take sannyas?
That's right.
So the other ones are just, they just take vanaprastha, if anything.
Yeah, but even they may not be interested in vanaprastha. Mm-hmm. That was the point I was making. Oh. That, you know, Kshatriya is supposed to take vanaprastha, but, you know, he's not going to be interested in doing it because he'll be bored.
And they called him out of retirement.
Need you
back.
Yeah, I mean, he'll be bored. That's what I've seen practically. I mean, we could say that, you know, a Kshatriya should stop managing or whatever, fighting at 50. But what are they going to do? It's not their nature just to sit and chant. I mean, obviously, by the process of devotional service, one can change their nature, one can actually be, but I don't see it happening so much. You know, I see people at 60 or 70, you know, I have many godbrothers 60 or 70 doing business. And it's not because they need the money. It's because they got to keep their minds engaged. I mean, yes, sannyasi, I mean, a Brahmin can take sannyas. That's true, but I mean, how many people are actually that Brahminical? I mean, we've been talking about right now retirement. There's a whole discussion going on in the GBC conference about retirement. You know, when is everybody going to retire? Should we retire? What's going to happen to the next generation? Succession plan? All this is going on. I'm seeing that there's going to be some difficulty if many of the present GBC retire for many reasons. One reason is they're so accustomed to manage, but they won't be on the GBC anymore, so they'll be creating havoc by being a, you know, parallel authority in ISKCON. That's one potential problem. Another problem is that they won't be around to guide the next generation. You know, so we're discussing what is the preferable process for someone gradually giving up their management responsibilities, but still somehow or other remaining in the loop as far as you guiding the society. Yeah.
Raj, an example from the days of yore with the country. We see Maharaja Yati, even Bhishma. They didn't retire until they were ready to retire.
Well, Bhishma was on a bed of arrows.
Yeah.
That was forced retirement.
Yeah, but he was ready.
Yeah, it was you're definitely ready when you're lying on your deathbed.
Right. But Maharaja Yati, he begged his youngest son to give him his youth.
Yeah.
And then he enjoyed life until he made the decision it's time to retire.
He got burnt out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting story because he compared himself and his wife to a goat.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was burnt out. Yeah, I mean, so basically one has to retire at the stage where they're mature enough to retire. It's not just like you're at a specific age. It's you have to have that realization and be ready. I mean, who is ready to sit down and chant Hare Krishna all day long? Especially with our passionate natures.
Problems with management is very similar to what's happening in Cuba.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Fidel has created such a vacuum.
Right.
That just being powerful about 50 years, he just did not train leaders.
That's right.
And that's what's happening in ISKCON. There are some people that are I mean, they were there since they were in their 20s, now they're in their 60s, 70s, and they still haven't given up that. So we have people in their 50s already, in
yeah.
their 40, they're not...
being trained.
Yeah, so
yeah.
by the time they're 60, they won't know how to do much. But to just follow certain people,
that yeah, you're right.
people won't be there.
They won't be there. Yeah, that is a problem. I agree with you 100%. There's going to be a leadership vacuum because many of us, you know, are holding on to our position too long. We're not training up other people. There's other reasons too. I mean, it gets a little more complicated than that. One of the reasons there's a sort of a problem with succession is that the next generation basically needs a means of maintaining themselves. They're not sannyasis. I mean, just to be honest. Like, on the present GBC, 95% of the GBC are sannyasis. Yeah, 90 to 95% of the GBC are sannyasis. Or they have some independent means of maintaining themselves. But the next generation, there's going to be some financial needs, which ISKCON doesn't have in place to meet. So that's another reason. Like, there's a lot of people who would want to take up responsibility, but they have to maintain their families. So it's a problem, that's one of the problems we're dealing with succession, is that they have to maintain their families. How are they going to afford to go to Mayapur for the GBC meetings? You know, so we have to have some sort of financial change in our movement so we can maintain some of the up-and-coming leaders. Because a lot of the up-and-coming people are not ready to live in the same way that I lived and Yogendra lives, right?
Yeah, I generally don't go to meetings in Mayapur because we don't have the money.
He doesn't have the money. But, you know, Yogendra's living like a Brahmin, for example. I mean, he's living very, very simply. Although he has a big family, 100 children. And not really.
But then they don't want to live the same way. They went out and had to find a way to make a living.
Yeah. So basically, you know, we have people with more financial needs than the first generation had or has. You know, because I'm a sannyasi, I mean, I don't have any financial needs. I mean, I get provided for anyway. You know, wherever I go, someone cooks for me. But someone cooks for me, I have a place to stay. I have so many people who give me a place to stay all around the world. That's not a... Yeah, I can just make my own little thing, but most of the devotees are not like that. So you have to face that reality too when we're talking about succession. That's one of the big issues we're talking about right now. We don't have the financial wherewithal to maintain people. I mean, even as far as temple presidents, I mean, if you have to start to pay a regular salary to a temple president, regular salary in America would have to be at least $30,000 to $40,000 a year. And that's poverty line basically in America, isn't it?
20,000 poverty line.
But still, you know, how many people can live on 20,000? Very few in America. Yeah.
Before on this point, I think that the thrust should be community development of self-sustained farm communities to do away with this need of money. So when you say we need financial, I disagree strongly.
Yeah, but we also have temples in cities too.
Right. And the city temples is a different scenario, which Srila Prabhupada wanted. That we show people how to live civilly, and we don't depend on money. The system
that's
of water.
I agree with you theoretically, and I also have lived that sort of life. But when we're talking about the practical reality that we have to face now, we don't see that. We don't see the people are willing to live like that. Now, why is that? We can say, well, they're not surrendered to Krishna, but I think I don't think it's good to go there, you know, to start to criticize people they're not surrendered to Krishna. The movement is in a different stage. In the first stage of our movement, it's called the charismatic stage. Of any religious society, you know, the charismatic stage is when you have the founder of a particular movement, religion, or something like that, and everybody's so enthusiastic. They're willing to surrender everything. They're willing to just hitchhike to go places like we did in the early days. You remember that, Yogendra? They're willing to live in to sleep on the floor with 40 other people in the same room, share one bathroom. You remember that stuff?
I mean, I remember sleep in the original Dallas temple. We had 30 people sleeping in the same room, and there was another room where the ladies slept, of course, and there was about 10 ladies in the temple, and there was only one bathroom for the whole temple. And yeah, it was ecstatic. I have to say it was extremely ecstatic. But do we have people willing to live like that nowadays for their whole lives? And also those people who live like that are no longer willing to live like that. I mean, I have to be honest, I can't live in a room with 30 other people, not knowing who's going to be next to me when I wake up in the morning.
But it teaches you to wake up early to get to the bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you want to go to the bathroom, you got to wake up. Otherwise, you'll explode. So, I mean, it was great training, but I don't find... I'm talking about America right now. Okay. India may be a different thing. Eastern Europe may be a different thing. But in America, Canada, I don't find people... And that enthusiastic to live that sort of life, because it's not the charismatic phase anymore, because Prabhupada, I mean, when Prabhupada was here, we were willing to do anything. We could live under trees. I mean, I had all my belongings in one box. The box I just got from a grocery store. You remember those days, Yogendra? Yogendra was there.
When I go to a temple president meeting, I still pack up my stuff in a box.
Well, you don't have a suitcase?
Well, I'm not flying. I'm just getting my car.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, you certainly have a suitcase now when you have a car.
I go find some old ones. You know.
Old car.
Old suitcase.
But in the early days, I remember just hitchhiking to go on Sankirtan, dumpster diving to get, you know, dumpster?
Tomatoes.
I mean, it was economically a different situation, because that's the charismatic phase. In the post-charismatic phase, things tend to become a little bit more normal, so we fit into society. And that means, practically, I mean, you could say in the farms, okay. But we have people living in the farms, but they're living normal situations. They have toilets and everything, don't they? They have toilets, running water, electricity. I mean, everybody here has those things. I don't find people just living in mud huts here. I don't find people, like in the early days in New Vrindavan, just going to the bathroom in a trench. I'll tell you a funny story. First time I went to New Vrindavan, 1971 or 72, I asked the devotees, where's the bathroom? And they said, it's up there in the hills. It was a trench with lime in it. You know what lime is? You know, so just to purify whatever fell into it. So it wasn't even an outhouse. And so, you know, how many people are willing to live like that? In the middle of the winter, too. I mean, it's one thing in the summer, you know, you're camping, you go in a trench, you know, a rainbow festival. But it was like below freezing. And we had to walk to take a bath. There was a stream and you had a plastic milk container you dip into the stream and pour over your head. I remember that when I went there, actually it took me 2 days to actually get the courage to go to the bathroom. So, you know, and then I remember going to the stream in the morning to take a bath and pouring this ice cold water over my head and screaming Hare Krishna. And then there was one devotee, I guess I could mention, it was Kirtananda. And he said, isn't this ecstatic? And I said, yeah, it's ecstatic. So, I mean, I don't find the devotees willing, because it's the post-charismatic phase, willing to endure those sorts of, especially as you get older. I mean, I could certainly, even at my age, I could camp out. I have no problem with that, but not in the middle of the winter. Not in the middle of the winter. And then people have families, they have children, they have health care. You know, children get sick, I think. You got to send them to the hospital. I mean, there's all these different needs that are there when you start Varnashram and you have families. In the beginning, it wasn't families. We never, if someone got married, we thought they blew from the Hare Krishna movement. Isn't it? I mean, basically, you know, someone got married, they fell down, you know, they fell down in Maya, they left the movement. I remember there's one sannyasi who came up to a grahasta and And the pastor was nicely married and everything like that. He said, oh, I'm so sorry you left the movement. And he was still chanting and everything. I mean, still chanting, following principles, going to Mangalarti, everything like that. It's just, you know, sorry you blooped. What happened to you? You know, you used to be a good devotee. So, I think things have changed. I mean, yes, simple living, high thinking is very nice. I mean, here, of course, we have tractors, we have all these other things. And Prabhupada's original vision was, if you want to light the place, you've got to use what? Castor oil beams, right? You've got to press the castor oil beams. You have to use oxen to plow the land. I mean, maybe in the future, if there's some natural disaster, if Dribhuj is right, then we're going to be doing those things. I mean, who knows? You know, he'll tell me, I told you so, after he's been predicting it. But I think, I mean, we're all using tractors and cars, right? And telephones and mobile phones and everything. And these things require money. And anyway, so practically what the GBC is seeing, as far as succession is concerned, there has to be money to support the next generation of leaders. Because they are generally married, they do have children, they do have necessities. And people, it's not like the early days of the movement. The people were just willing to live in any way. Right? I mean, a household, in the early days when Tamal Krishnamurti went to Europe to preach with his wife, who was married at that time, they had one room for four grahastha couples and they just put sheets to divide between the four couples. I mean, the room was about the size of the deity room. And they just put sheets, you know, hung sheets up on wires or ropes. And they had four grahastha couples living like that. I mean, that's a lot of surrender. Can anyone live like that now? I think it's very difficult. So that's my point. I mean, theoretically, yes, everyone should move to people should live simply, move on the farms, and use a latrine instead of a bathroom, go to the stream and wash your clothes in the stream. I mean, in the beginning, in New Vrindavan, Prabhupada wanted them to do that. He wanted them to wash their clothes in the stream, and the first time the devotees got a washing machine, Prabhupada was laughing at them. He called it Ugra Karma. You remember that story? They were carrying this washing machine up a hill, and little did the devotees realize that there wasn't electricity on the top of the hill. So there were four men carrying this old washing machine, you know, the type with a ring around it and everything like that, up a hill, and Prabhupada was laughing and said, Ugra Karma. You know, so, but who can live without? You have a washing machine, don't you?
Thank God.
What?
Thank God.
All right. Washing machines cost money. Water costs money. Electricity costs money. A car costs money. I mean, just like I have to wash my clothes today, and I asked Yogendra, is there a washing machine? And he said, no, go to the river. No, he didn't say that. But, you know, Prabhupada actually wanted that. Like India, you have these, like, scrubbing things, rocks. You just beat the clothes on the rock. And clean it, but who's willing to do that?
Just Nikunja, he still washes his clothes like that. He's from India, so he'll be beating them on the side over there because he doesn't want to pay. Doesn't want me to ask him for money to pay for the electricity because he's using the washing machine.
Okay, so everybody should do that. And that is better than paying electricity. That's true. Actually, it is true, but who is willing to do it? That's the problem. Anyway, when Prabhupada was on the planet, we would go to hell to please Prabhupada, isn't it? But still, even those people who are willing to go to hell right now are not willing, a lot of them are not willing anymore. But there was a certain enthusiasm, and that's called the charismatic phase. Post-charismatic phase means you've got to normalize the movement, fit into society, you know, have regular jobs, all that other thing. You know, there's money. You need money, right? In the beginning days, we didn't have money to pay the rent. I remember in Gainesville, Florida, where I joined, we didn't have the money. One month, we just didn't have the money to pay the rent.
So we just went out and prayed to Krishna, and some guy came up and gave us the $400 to pay the rent, and then disappeared. So many stories like that. But nowadays, you know, yogi has to be concerned with paying the taxes, right?
Taxes, electricity, many things. If you have a mortgage, and then if I put out a letter asking people to help pay for that, then you get some people who criticize you. Why do you still have the extra money just to pay for that? But then you have others like Ushai who said, they're gone.
How much is the electrical bill every month during the winter, let's say?
$1,500.
So you got $1,500. Where's that going to come from?
Mm-hmm.
And your taxes, what was it, $8,000 or so?
Almost six.
$6,000. Yeah, I saw that. So, that, I mean, you have these necessities, and if you have children, then there's more necessities. Children need clothes. And the interesting thing is they grow out of their clothes.
Very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, what do? You just like keep the children from growing? Like they do sometimes, they bind someone's feet so the feet don't grow? In the, you know, the Aborigines or something like that?
Chinese,
they do. I mean, what do? You have necessities. Your wife wants a sari. What do you say? You know, just get some cotton here in the fields and just make your own sari? Or jute. Jute is actually very nice. I mean, what do you do?
It's very coarse unless you can process it to some extent.
Jute, you mean?
Jute and cotton.
Well, it's sort of nice. I mean, I like a coarse cotton. So what do? You have all these necessities. We didn't realize it when they joined the movement. I mean, when I joined the movement, we didn't have dhotis. We went and bought bed sheets. And cut them and turn them into dhotis. Remember that?
It's always easier for a single man, you know, to
yeah.
Buy some way or another.
No, the women also use bed sheets as saris. And the yellow, what was the yellow?
It
was grahastas, yeah. Yellow dhotis and yellow saris was grahastas.
You had those bright orange brahmachari things.
Yeah, and then we didn't have kurtas then. We just wore our regular shirts, you know, Western shirts, right? At least my remembrance of that. I mean, it was t-shirts. It was ecstatic. I mean, you didn't have to worry about anything. It was a lot less anxiety than I have now.
Just paying the rent.
I mean, it was an easy life. But, you know, things have become much more complex. I mean, yesterday we were talking to Yogi about you have to get insurance for this place and everything. I didn't worry about that when I was 20 years old. I just chanted Hare Krishna and was happy. But somehow or other, the material world made its way known to me after 30 years in the Hare Krishna, you know, more than that, 40 years in the Hare Krishna, more than that, I think, in the Hare Krishna movement, 45 years in the Hare Krishna movement. Somehow or other, you know, I have to worry about money, you know, temples, all sorts of things. Anyway, I think this is one of the main discussions that the GBC is having about succession.
Make, like you're trying to make, a green temple. To make the green temple, you got to collect enough money to make the green temple. It's just like if we want solar panels, we have to have enough money to get the solar panels.
Yeah, it'll cost $300,000 to get solar panels for this temple. Ours is going to cost $500,000 for solar panels. I mean, of course, we're working out a deal where people can take tax credits and things like that. I mean, it's just... And then what do? Things break down. I mean, I thought once you build a building, you don't have to pay anything. But isn't it plumbing breaks down sometimes?
Oh, yeah.
Electricity breaks down. What do you have to pay a lot of money? I mean, we just had one window that got broken because someone was using a lawnmower or something like that. And it threw out a rock. And it's going to be like $300 or $400 to replace this window because it's double pane glass and everything like that.
Mahendranath had the lightning bolt hit the mast on his boat and blew out the lights.
Mahendranath's trying to get out and preach for the last 200 years. And every 2 weeks something happens, right? This is a material world. I mean, a lightning bolt hit his mast, blew out all the lights and all the electronics that were above the ship, on the top portion of the ship. And now it's probably thousands of dollars to replace all that, right? Material world is pretty expensive. It's actually, the more you have, the more you have to pay. And what we discovered in the early days, the less you have, the less you have to pay. Which was, I mean, that was nice. Could we live like that now? I don't know. I mean, could I live without a hot shower in the middle of the winter? I don't know. In the early days I did, yes. I was in New York City. And there was no hot water in the whole temple. It was like below zero. It was like having pins stick in your back when you were taking your shower in the morning. But I did it. Could I do it now? I don't know. I probably maybe could.
Well, like Prabhupada, disciples heated up some water and you take
it. Yeah.
So probably you did.
Yeah.
Somebody would be kind enough to give you water since you're an elder.
Yeah, since I'm elder and a sannyasi, there's no problem. But since, if you're not older and if you're not a sannyasi, you know, who's going to heat water for you? Sridevi, who's going to heat water for you?
My husband.
Oh.
He takes good care of
you. Okay, he's good. But I don't have a husband.
Krishna is your husband, Maharaj.
Krishna is my husband. I got to think about that one for a second. I know. I mean, I have people taking care of me because I have disciples. That's not a problem. But most people don't have that sort of facility. Yeah.
So you mean to say that you keep worrying about how to generate money to support the future leaders?
Yes. Yes, that's true. We all worry about that. Because
then that means these leaders will be giving their lives to ISKCON and they'll be supported by the organization.
Yes.
And you just said that in the future there'll be temples where it'll be closed for the night and everybody goes back to their jobs. It won't be like anybody.
No. I didn't say everybody goes back to their jobs. I say that in the city temples you have to figure out that most of the devotees are going to be working jobs. And they're not going to be living at the temple.
Like in New Orleans?
Like in New Orleans. Of course, New Orleans, the taxi drivers do live at the temple. But that's not all of them, but that's a unique situation. I think that obviously our movement's going to be congregationally based in the future because we can't be supporting everybody. I think like a normal church will support a minister or a Brahmin, you know, whatever we call it.
Depending on the size
but
of church,
at the same
you
time,
all,
you say that our leaders are going to be supported by ISKCON.
What?
On one hand, you're saying that the temple cannot support everyone, but on the other hand...
The temple will support a minister. And if it's bigger, it'll support a musical director, you know, like churches.
But then how is ISKCON going to support a whole slew of leaders?
Because each temple will support... Anyway, it hasn't been worked out. That's our question. The same question you're asking, we're all asking too. How will ISKCON be able to support all the people on a normal salary, or you know, even less than a normal salary, that will be required to maintain the society in the future? Because people are not going to be that willing to live austerely like we did, or we are living. It's as simple as that. And I'm asking the same question. The question you're asking, I'm asking too, and the whole GBC is asking. Where are the financial resources going to come from? And we have different devotees like Gopal Bhattaprabhu, who's an expert businessman, who's working on that. I don't have the answer to that question. But there will be need of more finance. Like in a church. Maybe we need to set up systems of tithing. Like if you go into any Baptist church, they always pay for the minister. I have one disciple who is a Baptist minister. You can't tell anybody he's a Baptist. I have another disciple who's a Muslim. He's a Muslim. Anyway, can't tell you where he is or else he'd get killed. But and they're supported by the church. Isn't it? I mean, any minister, there's a parish house right next to the church, usually, right? A pastor or a parish house, your parish if it's Catholic. And they pay a salary. I mean, my one disciple is a Baptist minister, he gets $60,000 a year for ministering to a small congregation. He only has 100 people come to on Sunday regularly. And he's still getting that salary because it's a culture that you support your minister. So in ISKCON, we have to develop that culture too. Not that we expect the minister or the Brahmin or whoever's in charge of the temple to live in a poverty-stricken condition. I mean, we're in America. India may be a different thing.
But America, we have to really be organized like the other churches are if we want to grow or be respected, isn't it? I don't see an alternative. I mean, if you want someone who's educated and with a family and everything like that to run a temple, how else is the person going to do it unless you maintain them? Right?
Or a lot of the people you get with something would be less qualified.
Yeah, would be less qualified. I mean, just like the way we ran Gurukula in the past, is we took the person who couldn't do anything else and we made them a teacher. Because they couldn't collect money, they couldn't cook, they couldn't do deity worship. All right, so you can take care of the kids. And it was an absolute disaster. So if we want Gurukul teachers too, we have to be ready. Or they have to have some alternative form of income, like if they're a professor in the university, you know, like Ananta Ram here. That's a specific...
Or people have to pay to go to school.
Well, people have to pay. I mean, Alachua, how much do they pay to go to the school there?
They do pay, I don't know.
Does anyone know? I think it's quite a bit. What I heard is $300 or $400 a month. Yeah. $300 or $400 a month. It's not much. No, it's very little for private school.
If you're a Catholic, you pay $5,000 a semester.
Yeah.
You go to an elementary school.
Not only do you pay $5,000 a semester, but you have to be part of the fundraising team, and you have to do all sorts of volunteer parental stuff.
You have to have money for you. You want to chip in, you know, beyond what you pay.
Yeah, beyond what you pay, you have to raise more money for the school. So, in the real world, I mean, it's taken me a while to live in the real world after I joined the Hare Krishna movement. In the real world, you have all these different needs that are there. You know, teachers need salaries. Teachers have families, unless they're crazy. You know, unless they're just, you know, but you don't want a brahmachari as a teacher. Basically, you want grihasthas, you know, as teachers, don't you? Let brahmacharis be monks and go on sangharana and do whatever they're going to do. So, yeah, grihastha means maintenance. They have children. Children mean diapers, clothes, food. Anyway, I think we've dwelt enough on because we have a need for food. At least to offer my deities something. And it's an interesting discussion. We can go on for a long time about it. But there's a reality. When you're managing the movement, there's a reality that you hit the wall, you know, the brick wall after a while, and you realize that you've got to face all these things that theoretically you didn't want to face, right? I mean, we never thought. Did you think about any of these things when you joined the Hare Krishna movement?
No, way back then. No. You didn't. Concerned about myself.
You're
seeing Krishna, becoming Krishna conscious, or getting liberated from the material world.
You didn't think about health care or anything like that?
No.
We still don't think about health care, insurance, long-term benefits, pension. We are here to serve this mission.
Well, I think about health care, long-term benefits, Medicare, Medicaid.
We don't even worry about money.
Well, you're more renounced than me. What can I say?
Yeah, but not the Superman.
Yeah, you're not worried about it, but Nanda Sutta's worried about it.
Yeah, because he has to do the earnings.
Yeah. So instead of saying, we don't even worry about money, say, you don't worry about money, but Nanda Sutta worries about it. Don't you worry about it, Nanda Sutta?
All the time.
See? So you didn't use the word right pronoun.
Right.
You should have said, I don't worry about money.
Yeah, because he takes care of
me. Oh, great. So can he take care of me too? Can he take care of the whole temple? No, because he's meant for you, not for... I know, but he's taking care of you. Anyway, everybody else has run away.
In the meantime, though, while we deal with that, we can also give facility and...
Oh, of course.
Get off the grid and...
But I don't see so much food being grown here.
There's some grown, though.
Yeah, you know, we have all these acres. We could be making money feeding yeah. New Orleans, basically.
Who's going to do it?
You.
Yes. We are doing on a
small scale. No, she just writes about it. She don't need to write
you. You're a Brahmin.
a little patch of land, we do grow things, but it's not enough to feed the whole community.
Is it enough to feed your family? Well, you can grow enough to feed your family on a little patch of land.
Right.
Anyway, we don't want to get into the whole thing, but we're different natures. It's not, I'm not expecting you to do farming. You're more intellectual. That's Varnashram. So there has to be a division of labor like that. And there's practical realities. I mean, the GBC service really gets you to understand practical realities of life.
Just and, like Tejas, his form is moving. He won't do it here in America because he says, I'll do it for farmers. He goes to India. We have so many people who are farmers and ready to join that type of movement.
Yeah, I mean, so many things in this world you got to face. I mean, especially the more responsibility. Just like recently, I mean, a few years ago, we had this lawsuit. If we hadn't taken care of that, if we just said, you know, Krishna, take care of it, what would have happened? We'd have lost all of our properties. So it's, you know, it's a real world, unfortunately, that's very difficult to deal with. And it's, you know, it's a headache. What can I say? It's a headache to deal with the real world. You gotta do it. Out of service to Krishna. I mean, I much rather, I was happier as a brahmachari where I was carefree and happy, happy-go-lucky. You can ask him. He knew me when I was a brahmachari. I was just happy-go-lucky, you know. Just chanting my japa, absorbed in the holy names. It was ecstatic. But, you know, can't go back.
Did you like the temple president or just went to the next?
Yeah, just went to the next temple. You know, I came here, and the first time I came here, actually it was a sannyasi. No, I was brahmachari the first time I came here. One time I came here, there was someone else who was temple president. And he didn't feed me. And I just went away. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
He said, you know, Maharaj, you're sannyasi, you should be austere. You know, he was eating all the sweets and everything, but he wouldn't give me any prasad. He followed the injunction that if you want to get rid of an unwanted guest, you don't feed him. It was the most austere temple I ever visited in my life. Okay, anyway, and that happy note...